I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, North Korea fired four ballistic missiles that landed in the sea off the northwest coast of Japan, three within the fishing and cargo ship zone. A few weeks ago, it fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile that also landed in the sea while the Japanese prime minister was visiting President Trump. On February 13th, the half-brother of the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-nam, was murdered at a Malaysian airport by a lethal nerve agent called VX. The Malaysian government expelled the North Korean ambassador yesterday, calling him persona non grata, after he suggested Kim died from heart failure. North Korea responded by preventing Malaysians from leaving the country, and the Malaysian government followed suit. The U.S. began deployment of an anti-missile system in South Korea that should be operational in a few months. We asked Philip Yoon to help us understand what is happening in this region of the world. He's the executive director and chief operating officer of Plowshares, a former official at the U.S. State Department with East Asia security and North Korea expertise. And Philip Yoon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Is North Korea trying to start a war?
No, they're not trying to start a war, but essentially what they are doing these days is seriously probing. They know that Donald Trump, they have a new administration in, and they want to see what Donald Trump's reactions are going to be all to the different things that they're doing. This is all in the context of a larger game in which they're playing, in which they are seeking to have a get a missile capability. Ultimately, they are hoping to get one that can eventually hit the United States. And they also are trying to get the ability to have a nuclear weapon mounted on one of those. So this is the longer game they're playing. And over the short term, there are military exercises that are going on, which they absolutely hate. And they're making that their displeasure known about that right now. So there's a lot of things going on, both in the short term and the longer term right now.
That's a very scary game.
Mm-hmm, it is. They are, essentially what is happening. I'm very worried about what's going to happen over the next several weeks. I'm worried about what we're seeing is the beginning of a tit-for-tat escalation. And what we're seeing is that these missiles that just occurred, the four of them, was, I think, a warning shot over the bow because it signaled the start. It was at the start of these joint exercises between the United States and South Korea. So what they're showing is a capability of precision targeting. And it is, to some degree, a desire to see if they can overwhelm by shooting four in a row this missile defense that's going to be shortly deployed in South Korea. And finally, I think it's a marketing tool. North Korea is known for its missile capability, and they're trying to see it was a source of high foreign exchange, and so it's a way for them to say, we know what we're doing and we can sell them.
Doesn't it make sense, though, for South Korea to want this anti-missile system, considering that their neighbor to the north is firing missiles into the sea?
Yeah, the THAAD system is something that is one way to show our commitment to South Korea. I think there's some real concern about this particular system. It's certainly better than what they had, which is the Patriot system, but there's some concern about whether it really there's concern of whether it's going to be effective at all. Right now, the way this is configured, it's not going to cover all of South Korea. It's almost like, I would say, a bullet trying to hit another bullet to shoot it down. That's what we're trying to do here. So from a technological standpoint, it's very difficult to do. And so for the South Koreans, it's a difficult call. It gives people some security, makes them feel like something is happening. But in fact, it won't cover all of South Korea. It's very easily overwhelmed with too many missiles. The North Koreans have a way to shoot off decoys, so the bullet that's trying to shoot down the missile will go after that instead, and overall the Chinese don't like it. So there's some real issues for the South Koreans in terms of whether this makes sense for them or not.
Is there a better system that exists?
Not right now. I think what we have to do is ultimately we have to show, and I think the North Koreans understand that deterrence actually works. The North Koreans know if they attack South Korea that the United States and South Korea would overwhelm them and virtually destroy them. So that in and of itself is the most important thing. And that's what does exist currently on the Korean Peninsula. And that's something that people have to keep in mind.
What role do you think China can play or should play in dealing with this crisis?
China is very important, but there's a myth out there. Everyone thinks that China can be actually can solve this all on its own, and in fact, it cannot. It is. We have to have Chinese cooperation on this. We have to have Chinese commitment on this, but it's not going to do it by itself. Essentially, what we have to do is try to get the Chinese to get an agreement with the Chinese. What's happening right now is that the United States, South Korea, and Japan are trying to put more pressure and are essentially blocking the front door. And what has happened up to now is the Chinese have been allowing everything go through the back door. So good cop, bad cop is actually a very good strategy when it's coordinated. But up to this point, it has not. And so what has to happen is we have to ultimately get the Chinese to agree to use much harsher sticks. But in turn, the Chinese are going to want the South Koreans, the United States, and the Japanese to use much sweeter carrots. Now, a good sign is this most recent coal ban. Now, it's a lot of people have not really talked about this, but in response to the VX news, the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, as well as the recent other missile tests that happened from from a mobile missile, the Chinese have said we're cutting our coal bans from banning coal imports from South Korea. That's huge.
From North Korea.
From North Korea. Excuse me.
No problem.
That's about 50% of its foreign exchange. That's a really big stick right now, and the North Koreans are livid about this. And so in certain ways, this is something that the United States has been telling the Chinese, we've been wanting you to do this. And in effect, what the Chinese are saying right now is, okay, we've done what you want to do, the United States. We've given, we put down a pretty hard stick. It's all in your court, and we want to see what you can do. And we ultimately think that you've got to give some concessions, some carrots to North Korea.
Is that a form of sanction in that it withholds money to the North Korean government? And sanctions can be effective, but they often will hurt the people living in that country. And we know, of course, the desperate conditions that most North Koreans live under. Are there risks that you're going to hurt the people and not the government?
Yes, there's always risks related to that. And so that's something that, and in our view, in my view, sanctions by themselves are never going to work. And that's why you have to have a combination of the two. You have to have some pressure, but you have to then offer the North Koreans something that they ultimately want. And so for us to get essentially what we want in the United States is a completely nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. That's going to be very, very difficult to do. What we can do over the short term is try to get the North Koreans to a freeze, essentially where they will not produce more nuclear material or more bombs. They're not going to make better bombs, which essentially is miniaturizing them. And what I mean by miniaturization is making it small enough to put on a missile, and then don't sell the stuff. In exchange, what the South Koreans want is some measure of security. They want respect, and they want to have their economies in desperate shape. So they want to have some aid and something that's going to help their economy. So those are the elements of a deal. They're there. The problem is for us to be able to find the right timing and being able to figure out how to make it work.
Can you negotiate with Kim Jong-un?
Yes, absolutely.
You can.
As far as and the history, there have been a lot of deals that have been done with North Korea. We are not going to, I think the question you're asking in certain ways is very similar to what people asked about whether a deal can be made with Iran. And I think the Iran deal is a very good example of what can be done with creative diplomacy. We're not trusting Kim Jong-un. You can't trust Kim Jong-un, just like we couldn't trust the Iranians. But what you can do is something where you have something that is monitored and modulated, and in exchange for one act, you're going to give another, so you're not going to give anything free. And so the North Koreans in the past have shown their willingness to do that and to follow through on a deal for the most part.
Are you worried that North Korea is or could be selling nuclear technology, if not to terrorists, at least to other countries that want some of this technology? And is their technology sophisticated enough that someone would want to buy it?
Yes, we have to worry about that. That is one of my medium to short-term, my medium to longer-term concerns. North Koreans, we believe, have sold or cooperated with the Syrians on putting together a nuclear facility.
Wow.
And that was destroyed by the Israelis in 2009. Now, thinking about what's going on in Syria right now, if that facility, which would have been able to produce a small amount of nuclear bomb-grade material, if that had fallen in the wrong hands, we'd be in a very different world right
sure.
now. So, yes, that is something that we have to be very concerned about. And, in fact, that's one of the problems that one has to consider related to sanctions. If sanctions work too well, what you have over the medium term is you're creating an incentive for people to sell that stuff. Think about it. If you had only, we think North Korea is on the verge, they have about 25 to 30 nuclear weapons worth of material. In about 4 or 5 years, they'll have 50. So if sanctions start working, you're part of this military brigade or you're guarding this material. Something the size of a softball would fetch a huge amount of money on the black market. So if your brigade, your family, or someone is starving and someone comes up and offers you $1 million, $5 million for something the size of a grapefruit, a fissile material, the stuff that goes, you know, that blows up, you're going to have a greater incentive to want to sell that. If the sanctions, on the other hand, are so strong and so onerous that you actually create a collapse, then what happens right. is that there's going to be a mad scramble
right.
to secure that material. And once that material gets out of North Korea, it will someplace at some point find itself in the United States, Europe, or perhaps Israel. And so that's what we really have to be concerned about, and that's why we have to figure out a way to put a cap on this particular activity.
About a minute before our break here, what about the use of cyber warfare or some kind of electronic strikes that could take out some of this technology, this missile technology?
Well, you're referring to the New York Times article that came out that you've been doing
yes.
all of that. Yeah. So, yes, I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised about those revelations. I had been assuming that's something that they would be doing. That's something that the United States did with respect to Iran. But it's not a solution. The way I look at it, it's sort of like a Band-Aid for a small cut in your knee when you're about to die of a heart attack. I mean, there's a larger issue here. This will give us a little bit of time. But in fact, it is just a matter of time before North Korea, if we continue with the same policies that we have right now, which is the series of sort of UN sanctions, condemnations, North Korea at some point over the next 5 to 10 years will have a fully functional small nuclear arsenal, about 50. They'll have mid-range missiles and longer-range missiles. And, you know, we have time. But this is where we're headed, and the cyber war can extend that. But unless we have a solution to deal with the problem, it's not going to be solved.
I'm going to keep you a couple of minutes after our break because sure. I do want to talk about the murder of the half brother, of the North Korean leader. That's Philip Yoon. He's executive director, CEO of Plowshares Fund. We are talking about the crisis happening. In and around North Korea. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I've been talking with Philip Yoon, head of Plowshares Fund, about North Korea firing missiles into the sea off the coast of Japan. Let me ask you just a couple of questions. Of course, there's much we do not know. This is the murder of Kim Jong-nam, half-brother of Kim Jong-un, in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. This took place at an airport. It took place out in public view. What is your assessment so far about what this murder is about?
At first, I was incredibly surprised about this, and I thought there was actually perhaps another entity that was behind this. And now it's become clear that it was actually definitely from North Korea.
Mm.
Aside from being a horrific crime with something with VX gas, which is something that should never be used, it gives me pause. I was very surprised because this is very different from what North Koreans traditionally have done. Usually when they have done these kinds of operations, they're very well trained, very efficiently, and they're highly coordinated with what's going on with the rest of the world. This particular attack was none of these. I mean, it was incredibly inept. They used a lot of They used amateurs for some odd story about a, you know, reality television. And most of all, the timing was all wrong for this. As I said before, Kim Jong-un is probing. He's probing a new administration, trying to figure out what, how people are going to react and how they're going to respond. And, you know, doing this particular thing right now just didn't make a lot of sense. In fact, what happened is that because of this, there was a scheduled set of talks between North Korean diplomats and former government officials, Americans. I was one of them in New York. And it, because of this particular operation being revealed, it was canceled.
Wow.
And then the other thing that you had was the Chinese ban, the coal ban, occurred. So South Korea, North Korea, then 50%, virtually almost 50% of its foreign exchange is going to be cut off from them. I mean, it's just very odd.
Do you think it was designed in some way to make the head of North Korea look bad or inept?
I don't think so. There are a couple things. One is that we know that Kim Jong-un has very much, there's a standing order to get rid of his brother, so we knew that. He feels threatened by his brother. There are a couple of meanings. One is that for whatever reason, Kim Jong-un internally is weak. And so if that's the case, the implication is that he can theoretically be more dangerous, more apt to lash out. The other interpretation is that he's actually consolidating power, and this seems to be coinciding with his firing of a security minister a couple of weeks ago, and that his consolidation, some people are thinking, is basically complete. If that's the case, what this indicates, he feels more empowered to do more provocative things, and that can then lead to more miscalculation on the Korean Peninsula, particularly now in, in these military exercise situation where you have thousands of troops on both sides roaming around the Korean Peninsula. There's a lot of accidents or miscalculations that could happen, resulting in rising tension and the possibility of a shooting war breaking out. So this is what I read when I think about the assassination, and I'm trying to piece all of this together.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. I know you have to run and take your kids to school.
Right.
Philip Yun, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Executive Director, Chief Operating Officer of Plowshares, and we were talking about North Korea. Well, Congress and the FBI are investigating alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and possible ties to the Trump campaign. Candidate Trump spoke admiringly of Russian President Vladimir Putin at a rally in October 2015.
I'll get along with Putin. I was on 60 Minutes with Putin. He was my stablemate 3 weeks ago. We got the highest ratings in a long time on 60 Minutes. You saw that, right? He was my stablemate. I believe I'll get along with him. It was Trump and Putin, Putin and Trump. I'd even let him go first if it makes us friendly.
After news of the hacking of the Democratic National Convention committee came to light last summer, Trump doubted Russia was responsible, saying this at the first presidential debate with Hillary Clinton.
I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC. She's saying Russia, 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 but maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay? You don't know who broke in to DNC.
A few months ago, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence released a report saying the CIA, FBI, and NSA have concluded there was Russian interference in the election ordered by President Putin, who had preference for Donald Trump. Well, yes, Karun Demirtan to join us on Radio Times, reporter for The Washington Post covering foreign policy and national security. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Let me just get a sort of a catch up on where things stand as of yesterday. And this was, of course, all over the news. We did a story about this yesterday. This was President Trump's claims that President Obama had ordered wiretaps at Trump Tower. Where does this investigation or this story stand today?
Well, this is kind of a big question right now, because Donald Trump and his staff did say that he wants Congress to investigate these allegations that he made, that his phones at Trump Tower were wiretapped by the Obama administration. And a few people in Congress are saying, okay, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee came out basically on Sunday and said, sure, we'll add that to the investigation. Now, meanwhile, there's a whole bunch of people on the Hill who are saying, wait a second, on what grounds are you making this accusation? This is a pretty serious accusation.
Sure.
Democrats are saying it's totally baseless, akin to when Trump said that Obama wasn't born in the United States. There's even some Republicans who are saying, wait a second, you cannot accuse a former president of breaking the law, basically, because these wiretaps need to go through a court process first. So if Trump is just saying this happened, you need to show some sort of evidence or explain both to members of Congress and the American people why you think that. But what's happened from the administration side is that there was basically nobody answered any questions yesterday. There wasn't a White House briefing. There wasn't a State Department briefing on camera, at least. And that means that, and the White House spokesman said, we won't be taking any more questions on this topic until there's an investigation, which is basically the White House saying, we're not going to tell you if we have any evidence or suggest maybe they don't.
Does President Trump, though, have it within his power to declassify whatever information he says he has and make that public, if not to Congress, make it public to the public?
I mean, he can make those things public if he wants to. As you alluded to, he probably was in consultation with the intelligence community. But this is the question, right? Because if he has information that it was done illegally, that's a very, very, very big deal. And like I said, that's the accusation that people want him to substantiate, if he's actually saying that Obama and his team went above and around the procedure. There were reports previously, last year, I believe, that there were applications made to the FISA courts for these wiretaps that were denied.
Right.
So the courts are supposed to be able to have the final say of whether there's actual just cause or, you know, whether they actually have any evidence that there's been communication with a foreign entity, in this case, because we're talking about Russia. So that's the one thing. If he does have evidence that it was done illegally, that's a very, very big deal and very, very bad for the former administration. If he has evidence that it was done legally, that kind of substantiates all of these, the reason for all these allegations and suspicions. Because if the court said, yeah, there is a reason to tap his phone, then all of these reports that the Trump administration has been denying, you know, oh, no, we don't have any special contacts with the Russians. Well, if the court said, yeah, there's a reason to tap the phone because of suspicious contact with the Russians, it kind of substantiates what all this reporting has been finding that the administration has been denying. Or the third possibility is that there is no evidence, and so they don't want to talk about it publicly because there's nothing there. And it's very difficult to know right now because we're going off of what started with a tweet. And it's since, you know, the Trump administration has rallied behind that tweet to say, yes, there's something here, you should be investigating it. But we don't know what that is, and there's been no other direction given, and people on the Hill don't even know. And even the FBI director at this point, he's talking to the Justice Department, Justice, you know, is the overarching umbrella over FBI, but saying, please say there's no there. So you have discord even within the administration about this, whether there's any substance behind this accusation. And we do not know yet because it's only been about 48 hours, or maybe slightly more than that at this point, it's Tuesday morning, since that came out.
It feels sometimes like a short time and also like a long time at the same time. Let me just give out our comment line. You can call or text us with any comments or questions that you have. We are trying to connect some of the dots here. This is a complicated story. Began about a year or so ago, trying to understand any kind of contact between the Trump campaign and Russia. 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How many investigations? I'm actually looking at a list here. It looks like the FBI has several investigations going, and there are also investigations from the House and the Senate looking into various aspects of this story. Are these investigations that are basically going on behind closed doors?
For the most part, yes. You had kind of on Capitol Hill, you had kickoff hearings for some of these investigations, and you've had the chairman and the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee is kind of giving updates occasionally to the press about what the parameters of the investigation are going to be, what types of contacts they're looking at. And usually it's been basically anything that seems suspicious between Kremlin officials and any campaign officials or surrogates. You then have the administration conducting its investigation far more behind closed doors than that even. I mean, we have substantiated the existence of those investigations in the press, but members of Congress are still waiting for verification from Jim Comey, the FBI director, that those investigations even exist. And this is fueling some of the tension and the discord between Capitol Hill and the administration right now, because they're saying, look, you're not telling us everything you know if we're finding out these reports in papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times, then you're not giving us full intelligence briefings to let us know. Democrats are saying you have to tell us more. Republicans are saying, yeah, you should be telling us more, and also we need to clamp down on these leaks. So that's the whole other political thing. But you probably have a more complete list in front of you than I'm going to be able to
No, that certainly captured it. That certainly captured it. I mean, what we know, and let me just ask you, we know that a candidate Trump or even businessman Trump had business dealings with Russia. We know Jeff Sessions talked with the ambassador from Russia. Jared Kushner was sitting in on a meeting. Michael Flynn went to a Russia Today event and also talked with the Russian ambassador leading up to the inauguration. The Trump sons have talked about getting a fair amount of money from their assets in Russia. Paul Manafort worked for a Ukrainian, the former Ukrainian president, who's a very pro-Putin individual. Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, also had dealings with Russia as a businessman. Same with Wilbur Ross. The list goes on and on and on.
Is there anything
illegal or wrong about what any of these people have done? Yes, Michael Flynn got fired for his conversation with the ambassador from Russia. But when you look at this whole list, is there anything untoward here?
Well, on the surface, not necessarily. You can talk to people. It's a free country. You're able to have conversations.
Exactly.
The question, though, is what was discussed? Taking aside the fact that, let's just leave off to one side that maybe there was something that was not on the up and up that just had to do with those transactions, just putting that completely to one side and just talking about the whole ascent to the presidency in the White House. If you are negotiating as a private citizen with a foreign entity and undercutting the government that is the government, that is not legal. There is a thing called the Logan Act, which has never been brought up in court. So this is a thing that, you know, when you bring this up, some members of Congress will scoff and be like, you actually believe that's a real thing? It's on the books. It's never actually been tried and successfully prosecuted or anything like that. But it is on the books that you are not supposed to do that as a private citizen. So if this was just a courtesy call, be like, hey, we're going to be in the White House. You mm-hmm. want to get to
this
know
is
you.
Flint. Yeah.
And some tea and, right, you know, whatever. That's fine. But if it's saying, you know, hey, the Obama administration just sanctioned, you know, you, like, there was right after Christmas, there was that, you know, 35 diplomats that were here with the Russians and related to their intelligence services were persona non grata and pushed out of the country and they shut down two facilities. If that discussion that apparently happened, I think the next day between Flynn and the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, if he said, you know what, tell Putin not to respond because we're coming into office soon and here's how we'll handle it. So just ignore the fact that the president, who's the president for the next month, is doing this because we will negotiate with you under the surface. You're not supposed to do that as a private citizen. And they were still private citizens. And like I said, it's never actually been something that someone's been dragged into court over, but that's not legal. So that's the question. And that's, you know, potentially the more innocuous end of what could have happened if there is, you know, any sort of more serious sorts of allegations that, you know, I don't know, maybe they're talking about ripping up Ukraine's issue. I'm speculating right now, and that's not fair and it's not right to do. But the point is, there is a whole host of topics that could have come up in that conversation that we don't know. We just know that Jeff Sessions said when he spoke to the Russian ambassador, Ukraine somehow came up. That's a bit of a red flag because there's very serious tensions with Russia and major issues with Russia over the sanctions and over the war that's going on in the eastern part of Ukraine. Were they negotiating on that point? Or were they just mentioning Ukraine in passing of, oh, we'll have to talk about that down the line? That's innocuous. But that's the thing. We don't have a transcript of these conversations. We don't know.
Well, we do have, and I've heard people that are in support of President Trump say, but, oh, Barack Obama, President Barack Obama was caught on tape talking to the former president of Russia, Medvedev, about more flexibility. You know, after the election, I'll have more flexibility to deal with Russia. And I've heard people say, well, you know, this is, yes, he was a sitting president, but nonetheless, there were efforts by the Obama administration to develop a more friendly relationship with Russia. What do you say in response to that?
Well, Oh, sure. Yeah, of course there were. There was that reset button that's, you know, kind of become the butt of a joke because they spelled the word reset in Russian completely wrong. But, you know, that's true. Everybody does come into office saying we're going to make things better with Russia. So, you know, in a vacuum, Trump's comments that you played at the beginning of this segment when you were saying, you know, oh, Trump and Putin will be so much better off. Had there been zero contacts with the Russian officials by the Trump campaign officials, had there not been that Paul Manafort connection early on and the Carter Page connection and the Michael Flynn connection, had it been pretty much, you know, him just saying that, not a big deal. I really don't think anybody, I don't know, I can't say for certain, you know, it's a counterfactual, but it really wouldn't be a big deal to say, hey, we're going to make everything better with Russia because I was in the green room, you know, I was on the same show with Putin and I think I can do this. Fine, that's very similar to saying things as a campaign point. Sure, why not? It's because there seem to be these connections and other financial connections that go along with it, right? Because then you start to think about, like, well, is there a little bit of a quid pro quo here going on potentially, or is something else up? And like I said before, the statute that says that you're not supposed to do this sort of negotiation with a foreign entity as a civilian has never actually been, you know, nobody's been dragged into court or jail or anything like that over that. But there is a difference between a sitting president, you know, saying we're going to push the reset button or tell Vladimir that, you know, things will get easier in a month. And someone who's not the president yet, because you have this, who is speaking for the country? You're supposed to have a single, well, I mean, a single administration voice, let's say that. I know there's different voices in an administration, but
right. It
is supposed to at least be, you know, that's why the bulk of the foreign policy power is in the executive, because you can't have a million different, you know, negotiations happening at the same time because they undercut one another. Where is the United States when it comes to these diplomatic things?
Karun,
it's supposed to be with the sitting administration.
Hold on to that thought. We're going to try to get you on a better phone line. We're also going to take a very short break. We're talking about what we know, what we don't know, where investigations stand related to Russia and the Trump administration or the Trump campaign. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Have you been following the twists and turns regarding allegations that Russia interfered with the 2016 presidential election? Have you lost track of what is known and not known? We certainly have. And that's why we asked Karun Demirjian from the Washington Post, who covers foreign policy and national security, to join us. You can call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. Let me play another clip, and this is from the second presidential debate at Washington University in St. Louis. This was on October 10th, and of course, his debate partner was Hillary Clinton. Let's give it a listen.
But I notice anytime anything wrong happens, they like to say, she doesn't know if it's the Russians doing the hacking. Maybe there is no hacking, but they always blame Russia. And the reason they blame Russia is because they think they're trying to tarnish me with Russia. I know nothing about Russia. I know about Russia, but I know nothing about the inner workings of Russia. I don't deal there. I have no businesses there. I have no loans from Russia.
What do you think, and I'm to back obviously to you, Karun, what do you think then about the various statements that Donald Trump has said, both about Russia but also about Vladimir Putin, that he knows Vladimir Putin very well and then he knows him not at all. They spoke, they have no relationship. There's a lot of sort of A and B-ing of his various comments that he's made about the Russian president.
Right, and this is why I think a lot of people are skeptical, because if your story keeps changing on something so simple as, you know, did you ever meet the head of a foreign country that's a pretty recognizable foreign country, then, you know, what are you just being forgetful? Are you just talking off the cuff and changing your story? Or are you trying to cover up something? And I think that is what has a lot of people scratching their heads and saying, wait a second, why can't you just give a straight answer on a very simple question? And he's contradicted himself. That's the other thing. You know, it's when someone kind of talks themselves into circles, then it's very easy as an observer of that to say, well, which one's true, right? And when it comes to Russia, I mean, perhaps, you know, there's the experience of this country with Russia is, you know, very, very much colored by the Cold War experience, because that was 70 years of how we dealt with Russia. There was a period in which things were supposed to be better. You know, the 2000s were, for the most part, you know, not that inimical. But ever since about 2008 and the war in Georgia, things have been tense with Russia. And then 2014, when the Ukraine crisis started and the Crimean annexation, all of a sudden Russia is back in the center of things and not as a friend. And so, you know, you kind of have to be careful about how you talk about Russia, and you just want your story to be straight when you say whether you, you know, met with somebody or not. Now, granted, in the last few days, there have been, I mean, Trump has been lashing out at several members of Congress who have either said they didn't have contacts with certain Russian officials, or, you know, that they weren't significant, and then finding pictures and old stories. And
Schumer, Chuck Schumer being one, yeah.
Chuck Schumer, although Chuck Schumer didn't say he didn't have any contacts. Nancy Pelosi had said she'd never talked to the Russian ambassador. I think Claire McCaskill is another one who said she never met with a single Russian official, all of which have proven to be false. But their thing is basically like, look, there's a record of it. I didn't do it behind closed doors. I didn't do it shadily. There was press. There was a picture, you know, and yeah, okay, I forgot. You're right. But, you know, I wasn't under oath, and there's a record of it. So this is a back and forth. Can you forget these things? Sure. If you keep the subject keeps returning to it, it keeps coming back to it, and your answer changes two or three times, and maybe you should get your story straight if there's a straight answer, and then just kind of level with everybody, and maybe you'll go away, unless there's something else there. And the thing is, it's not just Trump. It's so many of his surrogates, so many of his former, you know, campaign officials and transition team officials that seem to have these connections that are not publicized, are not, you know, reckoned with before they become subject for speculation. And that leads people to think that, okay, that may very well mean that there is something legitimately to be concerned about there.
You mentioned Ukraine, and there's a story that just came out in the last couple of days looking at the Republican Party platform, that there was an effort, and apparently a successful effort, to water down a bit of the policy towards Ukraine, that no weapons to Ukraine, Ukrainian fighters who were fighting Russia and rebel forces, that was watered down and actually requested by Donald Trump. Can you clarify that one way or the other?
Right. Well, the reporting about that having been watered down came out at the time of the Republican National Convention. The news of the last few days is that there has been bragging from, I believe, Trump himself, or if I'm misremembering that, then from Trump administration, saying that, yeah, we got that done. That was done by us. I mean, the reporting at the time suggested that it was Trump's top surrogates that wielded that change. And basically, the significance of that is that in the United States, Congress, the Republican Party, for the most part, has taken a very hawkish stance on Russia. And part of that has been saying we will provide lethal aid to Ukraine. Now, they greenlighted this lethal aid to Ukraine several times in the budgets, but the Obama administration never actually sent that lethal aid to Ukraine. So mm-hmm. We're dealing with a situation where it's not really a pullback because the Obama administration didn't like pull the trigger and push go. And the reason that they didn't do that is because it's considered something that it's potentially a live wire, right? You send lethal aid to Ukraine. Russia is not afraid of taking preemptive measures to strike at Ukrainian army officials before they're able to use that lethal aid, and you may end up baiting Russia into stepping up the hostilities, which will increase the death toll, which will make Ukraine that much more unstable. So that's why the Obama administration kind of held back on that. But the policy of most members of Congress and certainly the Republican Party was that we want to do that. That is what like our goal is. And so to actually take that off the table is a significant kind of nod to Russia, saying we're not going to potentially make you upset.
Let me play a comment that David from Flemington left on our comment line.
This is David from Flemington. My question is, if the Senate Judiciary Committee were to unanimously approve the people next highest to the Attorney General, would that give enough confidence and trust to all sides for the investigation not to require a special committee?
And there is a question about whether to have what kind of investigation, Karoon, into Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who did recuse himself for certain aspects of this investigation into the campaign of Donald Trump, whether there's a need for a special prosecutor or whether this is something that Congress can do itself. Where does that stand?
Well, yeah. So today, the Trump pick to serve as Deputy Attorney General is getting vetted by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Your caller is potentially going to be disappointed because I do not think that it is going to be a unanimous vote in favor of him based on how a lot of Democrats were talking. But, yeah, if everybody was super comfortable with him and saying, oh, no big deal at all, then sure, maybe all of this, you know, calling and clamoring for either a special prosecutor or for a special committee on Capitol Hill, which are two separate proposals, would go away. But it's not going to go away. The reason that Democrats are upset is because they're saying, look, maybe Rosenstein did not meet with any Russian officials. We don't know. But if he is...
He's the Deputy Attorney General. Yes, I'm seeing him on my TV screen here. Yes, go ahead.
Exactly, the nominee for that. So if confirmed, which he probably will be confirmed, but if he is in that position, he's still serving at the pleasure of the president, right? Mm-hmm. So what is he going to be able to be independent enough that if he sees something that he thinks is shady, actually, you know, push the DOJ investigations and the FBI investigations into digging into Trump in a way that, you know, is potentially going to implicate the president? What if he's fired before he can do that and replaced with somebody else? But the Democrats want at least continuity. They want the independence and they want the continuity. And they're saying nobody who's put in this position by the president can actually have that independence because he can fire them at any time. He fired the acting attorney general, Sally
Gates. Over the travel ban.
That happened. Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Then you know, this Dana Bente that he appointed, who's going to be going. Then what if Rosenstein finds something that Trump doesn't like and he fires him too? Where's the continuity of that investigation? I mean, certainly there are hundreds and hundreds of other people at the departments that are working on this much more closely, but still, that's why they're saying, Democrats are saying, as a first order of business, Rosenstein has to commit appointing a special prosecutor, or we won't back him.
Let me read a text from a Delaware listener. Did any people working for the Clinton campaign have contacts with Russians during the campaign? In other words, is it normal business for presidential campaign people of any party to meet with significant foreigners? And I'm thinking of the Clinton Foundation and the problems that created for Hillary Clinton herself. But we touched on this earlier, but is this highly unusual to have all this contact with a country such as Russia?
It's highly unusual to have so many people that have not necessarily been in politics and representing the government already having this much contact. But I will say that the investigations that are going on are not only focusing on the Trump campaign and transition team and administration. They're focusing on both.
So every time
you see these investigations, they're talking like, I think I said before when I was talking about the parameters of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee investigations, it's between Kremlin officials and campaign officials, not just Trump campaign officials, any campaign officials. So they're looking at, they are technically looking across the board, and I'm sure the Republicans are not letting go of that line of inquiry. It just seems that it has not yielded as much fruit thus far as the members of Trump's team that seem to have these contacts that don't make any sense, or at least don't make that nobody's fessing up to and are thus raising question marks in everybody's head.
Let me ask you about the hacking of the DNC. And there was some question about the Obama administration knowing about the hacks, but keeping that information either quiet or even secret, or certainly not going public with it, I think for fear of looking partisan. But what was the thinking, do you think, behind the Obama administration on that note?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speculate.
Unfair question. I realize that.
No, it's fine. You're right that there is this, it's odds, right? Because there's a period that comes before an election where you're not supposed to be letting anything out of the bag that really could swing the electorate one way or another dramatically. And the more famous example, like, I guess, of this in the 2016 election is that this is why Democrats are so mad at the FBI director, right? Because he came out and he said that thing about Hillary Clinton's emails. You know, the Anthony Weiner investigation might affect that in some way. And they're saying, oh, my God, you're not supposed to talk about these things this close to an election. It's the end of October. Like, so if that's the rationale, that's one rationale that could be for saying if we don't have hard proof, if this is still, you know, evidence that's being gathered, then we can't just let it out there if we can't say what it means. If it's during the transition period, less clear about what the rules on that are. And I think a lot of people, both Republican and Democrat, are upset about this revelation because the Republicans are saying, you know, were you trying to plant stuff, basically? And Democrats are saying, if you knew this stuff, why didn't you at least tell the members of Congress who are privy to the very highest level of intelligence briefings? There's something called the Gang of Eight. on Capitol Hill, which is the leaders of all of the parties in the House and Senate, and then the leaders on the intelligence committees in the House and Senate. And they're supposed to get regular quarterly briefings from the administration. They're pretty detailed and have the most information that anybody sitting in the legislature would get. And they're saying they didn't know. And so they're very upset that maybe that they weren't looped in because they feel like they should have been told these things. So what the rationale was, I think that maybe we start to find that out alongside everything else that we're inquiring about in these investigations, if they yield fruit. If not, I'm loath to speculate at this juncture of what was going through their heads on that decision.
Well, let me ask you to speculate about the dodgy dossier, as it is called. And this is from the British, I always forget whether it's MI5 or MI6, but British
Six, I think,
intelligence yeah. officer talking about collusion between Russian operatives, I guess, and the Trump campaign. Also that there was compromising information about candidate Donald Trump. Where does this stand? This is a guy named Christopher Steele. I was reading more recently that the FBI finds at least some of what he has said credible. Where does this stand?
Well, they find him definitely credible as a source. I think he's somebody that's familiar with the intelligence committee in the United States, intelligence community in the United States. They, you know, trust him as a source. The question is the sources that he is relying upon in that report. And, I mean, I don't want to repeat any of the allegations here because they're all unsubstantiated. And my paper did not publish, the full copy the way I think it went online at BuzzFeed. But I think that they are trying to see if they can replicate that trail, right, and figure out, credible potentially means true or potentially doesn't mean true. It just means, you know, a nice try. And I think that that's what the intelligence community is trying to figure out in many ways. I mean, certainly there was very salacious details in that dossier. There were also allegations about things that are maybe not as sexy, but like might raise greater concerns having to do with financial connections. I think the question always in the back of everybody's mind, though, as they're looking at this, is those sources that Steele relied on, are they legit sources that he found? Are they people that the Russians planted to play him? I mean, it's not
sure.
Totally clear at this point. I think that's what we're waiting to bridge the gap from credible to whatever it actually is in terms of the truth scale.
Karun, about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. Why so much leaking? What does that tell us?
Oh, that tells us that the people in the administration aren't necessarily happy with what's coming out from the top line. Usually when there's leaks, that means that people that are working in the more, you know, the rank and file levels of these agencies think that there's something that the public needs to know. It can mean sometimes that people have a political agenda, but most of the people at these agencies are not political appointees. They may have leanings one way or the other. And of course, the Trump administration has said that it's a smear campaign to make him look bad by people that were loyal to the Obama administration. That could be it. It also could be that they don't like what the administration is saying. And so they're pushing this information out to the press as they can in order to counter that story.
Karun Demirchian, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers foreign policy and national security. And we began our hour talking about North Korea with Philip Yoon, Executive Director, CEO of Plowshares. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.